Welcome back. Has everybody been here more or less for, has seen us before, so we don't have to give a long introduction about who we are?
Skip it.
Great. I'm Chris. That's Katie. All right. So we're going to talk about, we're going to move towards, we're going to do a little review, do a Bible study, a little review, and move towards thinking about some technical tools and some tactics to think about how you, in whatever your context is, that may be a congregational context, but whatever your context is, thinking about what it might look to take a step towards engaging in public witness in a realistic way in your actual context. So, but first we're going to do a the quick and dirty Bible study. We're not going to go. We could spend a week on this, like Glenn is spending with Ruth. We're not going to do that, sadly. But I will read Luke 8, 26 through 39 for us. So then they, disciples, arrived in the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. As Jesus stepped out on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wilds. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. They begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. Now there on the hillside, a large herd of swine was feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these, so he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When the swineherd saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came out to see what had happened, and when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed. Then all the people in the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." So he went away, proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. So much to say about this passage. By the way, does anybody recognize this? This is called the Brick. This is from the Brick Testament. This is somebody who does the Bible in Legos. Right? It's not as adorable as you might think, though. It's actually relatively graphic sometimes, because the Bible is pretty frightening. But it's in Legos, so it's more fun that way. So, without getting into, there's a great deal we could talk about this passage, where the Gerasenes are in relation to Galilee, it being a Greek area rather than a Jewish area. But what we'd like you to do is just turn to a neighbor, groups of three, whatever it is, and for 2 minutes, talk about how do you see Jesus as being a disruptor? How the man was changed?
The man who was healed.
Man who was healed. And how was his community, the man who was healed, how's his community changed? So turn to a friend, a small group. We're going to be doing lots of small group discussions. So if you just want to move yourself to a place where you can talk to other people, that would be useful for today.
Maybe we should have Juju one way that way.
Jesus changed the person.
How is the man changed?
Choices and that.
And people that take the Bible and lose it.
The fact that he was supporting the...
I'd like to think we would.
Here's his access to...
Yeah, and so I think there's room to update how we aspect.
What did you say?
All right, there is too much to say about this passage. If you have loved to hear an insight, an observation, something to share with the group. Does anybody have any insights about disruption, change in the individual, and change in the community? Yeah.
Don brought up a great point that Jesus was actually paying attention to this guy, but who was really, would make most people feel really uncomfortable and would pretend we weren't seeing him, or maybe be in a conversation with someone so you could ignore them, and
we're good at that.
Which we all still do that all the time.
We're good at pretending, right?
And he just went right up.
Yeah, not notice. I mean, I love, Glenn's been talking so much about noticing what we notice, and Jesus noticing the man.
Mm-hmm. Wait, we had a similar thing right here in terms of this being uncomfortable, because I know I was a little bit uncomfortable with Alex being here.
Mm.
And at one point I had somebody with his disease. I had went and got him and took him to church and what have you. So it isn't like I was, but I'm still a little bit uncomfortable.
Sure.
And it feels bad.
Yeah.
It feels bad to be uncomfortable about that.
Sometimes it's important to name our discomfort, and to name our discomfort in a place, that's appropriate and helpful, and name our discomfort with trusted people in a place that they can help us change. I wonder if the people in this town have been able to name their discomfort amongst one another. I'm guessing not.
And Jesus was a foreigner coming in and doing it. He was not one of them.
Sure. The outsider, sometimes the consultant can come in and tell you things that you already kind of knew but didn't want to hear.
It was, I think, more on that lines of, I don't know, the Greeks and the Israelites, that they had a...
Can't hear you.
In terms of Jesus was an Israelite and this was a Greek community. And so you hear a lot about how the Israelites were not well thought of. And I don't know the relationship between these two, but so you have this person of questionable heritage coming in and doing this very powerful act.
Right.
And now you've just disrupted the entire order of, wait a minute, this person now is normal. And it was, this Israelite here, this Jew, that showed up is... what else is he going to do?
Right. I love that the disrupting the order. Who belongs where? Who has power and influence? All of these things are now up in the air.
Do that. Yeah. What else could he do?
The fear that shows up. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
In the case. That's a huge.
Yeah.
That could have been years of income. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but.
Yeah. How much of it is like, please leave the town. We're going to be poverty-stricken if you stay here for any longer, right?
Just in the language of the session this morning on Ruth, I would say Jesus crossed the border,
yeah.
You know, from Israel.
The Sea of Galilee represents this. Actually, it says throughout the Gospels, you know, he goes back and forth across the sea, and the sea is this border that he transgresses over and over again. Well, I would love to continue this. We're going to have lots of time for a continued conversation. This is a very conversation session, but I'm going to turn it over to Katie. She's going to make sure we're still on the same page. You've seen this slide, but we're going to go over it again.
Yes, so since we've all seen this for a couple days now, I'm just going to give a really brief summary. Again, we've been talking about faith as something that is personal, that encompasses our entire lives. We don't have separate faith lives and public lives, or Sunday morning life, and then Sunday afternoon through Saturday evening life. Faith encompasses our entire lives. It makes it a whole claim over our whole selves. Faith is also public. We are all parts of communities. We are made to be in relationship with each other. And so since faith encompasses our whole lives, that also includes our lives in relationship and community with other people, which is public. It's not just us by ourselves, but it is with other people. Faith is also political. Politics is concerned with organizing ourselves for the common good to actualize that in the community. And so faith, since it is public, works toward that as well. And reading the Gospels, there are so many calls made in them to work toward the common good, to look out for the needs of our neighbors, to work for the reconciliation of the whole world. So that's working for the common good. So faith is political. But faith is also nonpartisan. It does not align itself with a particular political party. Chris defined partisanship last night as just kind of the power to get things done, the power to win, advancing a particular agenda. Faith is not, it doesn't align itself with a particular political party. I mean, there may be some overlaps between things that the Bible tells us and particular policy platforms by a party. But faith doesn't bless an entire party because parties don't always get it right. One policy could be really great and then another goes against what our faith says. So faith does not bless a political party. It is nonpartisan. So just kind of thinking about all of this together, this morning Glenn was talking about this question of kind of this relationship between personal pietism and public policy, and when does our personal faith or what we do in our churches connect with public policy, connect with what's going on in our communities, in our country? And so I think a lot of it, or at least what Chris and I have discovered, is just kind of taking those personal experiences that you have with your faith, that are motivated with your faith, and then translating those into public action. So one example that comes to mind is, let's say your church went to the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C., a big rally against gun violence. You went there because your faith says that, no, we should not live in a culture of violence or fear. So you showed up. But while there were so many different speakers who gave personal narratives of how gun violence affected their lives. There was an 11-year-old girl from Alexandria, Virginia, named Naomi Wadler, who just gave this beautiful testimony of just how it affected her life as a fifth grader. And her story has stayed with me, as I'm sure it has with many people. And it kind of makes that shift into, how does this affect public policy in our life together? Where when we go and talk to our senators and representatives on the state or national level about the issue of gun violence, we're thinking about Naomi's story. When we go to the polls, we are thinking about Naomi's story. We are taking that experience we had that was motivated through our faith lives and potentially with our faith community, and then translating it into public action and perhaps a shift in policy. Another example is last night Chris was talking about how his church community has a meal for homeless folks every Sunday evening. And he talked about Arlene, a woman who comes most weeks, and how members of his congregation have gotten to know Arlene and have heard her story. The hope is that those people carry her story with them when they go to talk to their legislators, when they go to the polls, when they go to participate in the formation of public policy. So that's kind of taking your personal faith, and which encompasses your whole life, and translating it also into some political action. So that kind of leads into this working definition of public witness that we've been working with the last couple of days. Public witness first acknowledges that we are part of the world in its brokenness, and second, acts out God's story of reconciliation in public. So public witness sees and names what is broken in the world. It sees gun violence. It sees racism. It sees that some people don't have housing or enough to eat. And then it steps out and it acts and takes concrete action to work with God to solve those problems, to creating a world that better reflects the world that God, or the world as God intends it to be. So a world that we see as full of division is now seen as full of unity, and we work toward that. A world where there is racism, we see a different vision of the world in which there is reconciliation and love and respect for all people, and we take active steps to live that out in our lives. A world where some people are hungry, and a vision of a world in which everyone is fed, and again, take active steps to live that out. And so, with that, to recap last night, Chris and I told some concrete stories of the ways that our congregations are living out public witness, both in terms of different steps that we have taken toward working toward unity, but also kind of addressing other issues I just raised, like racism and food insecurity. But today, as Chris said, we are going to be focusing on some practical tools that you can take with you back to your own context to kind of figure out what public witness looks like in your church, in your community. So I'll hand it over to Chris.
But first, before we get to the tools, I want to tell you about our dog. This is actually, oh my gosh, she's huge. She's not really that big in real life. She is, this is Kisco. Kisco is our dog who is staying with my parents right now up in Connecticut. She is a 7-year-old pit bull boxer mix. We adopted her a couple of years ago, and she is delightful in every single way. So that's one thing you should know about us, that we have Kisco, this dog. The other thing that you should know about us, and perhaps you've figured out by now, is that we're going to be having a baby soon. So these two facts present us with a challenge. And the challenge is that Kisco, as sweet and delightful as she is a little nervous around kids, as we've observed, right? She sees kids and she goes, what's that? I think she can't figure out if a kid is like another dog or a kid is like a human. Like, she can't quite categorize it, so she seems a little terrified or sometimes too eager to love. So we have this challenge, right? So we did what we thought any good responsible dog owners who were going to have a kid would do. We hired a dog trainer, right? We knew this dog trainer from my sister. My sister's two dogs were fighting. The dog trainer came to help them with it. The dogs get along, right? Okay, so we hired this dog trainer named Karen. And so we're thinking to ourselves, great. we're going to, Karen's going to come over and we're going to say, well, we've got this problem. The problem is that we're not sure how Kisco feels about kids, and we're going to have a kid, and we need you to solve this problem, and we're just going to fork over some cash at you, right? Okay. You probably know how this is going to end if you've had a dog before. So we hire Karen, she comes over, and she sits down, and Kisco immediately loves Karen because she's just got this like bag of like treats, and so the treats are just coming out constantly, and Kisco's like, I love you more than anything. And so we're ready for, you know, like Karen's gonna start working with Kisco and give us a quick solution. And she starts asking us questions, right? Like, well, tell us about your life, right? What are your daily patterns? What are the things you do every day? What are your hopes? How do you relate to your dog? Do you do all these things, right? We're like, no. We just want you to fix our dog, right? Like this is. We hired you for this thing, and it became clear relatively quickly that she wasn't just going to quickly fix our problem, right? Because she kept asking questions about us and questions about the culture of our home and our expectations and our hopes, and also questions about what we were willing or not willing to do, what was going to be possible for our lives or not. And so we came into thinking about the challenge of Kisco and future baby as a technical challenge, right? And our world is full of technical challenges, right? A technical challenge is my car's brakes squeak, and so I'm going to go get them fixed, right? A technical challenge is, well, you can probably name your own technical challenge. And a technical challenge is something with a clear problem, a clear solution, and usually requires an expert or expertise to get there. So we came to Karen with what we thought was a technical challenge, and she turned it around on us and said, actually, and she didn't use these words, but I'm going to use these words, actually what you have is an adaptive challenge. And so this is the paradigm that we want to work with for the next 35 minutes or so. We have an adaptive challenge, and the adaptive challenge asks us questions about what are we willing to change about our own lives? What culture, what sort of home culture do we expect? What do we hope for? What are we willing to do, right? And so she turned it back on us. She says, well, I'm going to give you the tools to solve your own problem, right? I'm going to give you the tools to help you reflect on your own context, the context, of course, being our home and our family, in order to bring lasting, adaptive, contextually appropriate, long-term solutions to what you thought was just a simple technical challenge, and it isn't a simple technical challenge. It's much harder, but it's something that we had to do ourselves. So we want to bring this into the, for us, it's the church paradigm. For you, it may be another community paradigm. To stop thinking about challenges as having two streams, right? The two streams of the technical challenge. Here's one we use sometimes to describe this, and this happens in churches all the time. That somebody comes and says, and has an accessibility issue, right? I can't get into your church, right? There's an accessibility issue, whether it has to do with age and mobility or other mobility issues. We have a technical challenge, and we think to ourselves, we get together in a committee and we say, all right, we're going to make sure our ADA entrances and exits are all up. We're going to make sure there's elevators. We're going to make sure if somebody can't get to church, we're going to get a church van, and we're going to get, make sure that, we're going to go around and pick folks up in the morning. That's a technical solution to a technical problem. What if we looked at it as a cultural challenge to be met, mm-hmm. right? What if we looked at it as, what does our community look like? Do people with mobility challenges, are they connected to people who are who don't have those mobility challenges? If it has to do with age and mobility, are we genuinely a multi-age and connected congregation? Do the youngest people in our congregation have relationships with some of the older people in our congregation? Those issues take longer to solve and longer to address, and they're not easily solved by an expert. They're the questions that we need to think about and solve for ourselves. So we want to think about the idea of public witness as not a technical problem, right? How can we get people to go to a protest? How can we get people to vote for these issues? How can we get people to live there, to express their faith in a particular way? What we want to ask the question is, what do the cultures of our context look like? And how can we deeply understand our context in order to make make changes that address our hopes, our fears, the things we're good at, the things we struggle with, and to help people move in a whole way towards whatever goal it is out there that we hope to see. And so this is what we're now going to do this. Katie's going to lead us in a couple of exercises, and we're going to talk to each other, and we're going to attempt to actually do this and leave with one or two things that we could do.
Yeah, so the first thing we need to do before addressing an adaptive challenge is analyze our own context, kind of know what's going on in the community, on the ground, kind of in the culture, and just get a really good sense of that, because you need a good sense of what's going on in order to make plans for where you want to get. So like last night we were talking about how, like, maybe your church is here and you want them to be on the other side of the room where Chris is. And maybe, like, as you analyze your context, your church can take that huge leap and go across. But maybe, like, as you're kind of looking at what's going on the ground, maybe that is just too far a leap for where you all are at right now. And instead, one step forward is what you need. And so knowing your context helps you determine, like, what is that next step that we can take? And then from there, what is this other step? And so on and so forth. So some questions you need to ask are, like, what are we good at? Like, maybe we are really good at getting people to, like, come together and sit down and share a meal. That's great. So you can put that on the list of things you're good at, and then kind of file that away to think, to use to make a plan later on. Like, maybe that turns into, like, oh, we can bring people together to have a community conversation or something like that. Just, you can read all of them, but what I'm going to highlight is asking a question about what makes us uncomfortable. What are we avoiding? Like today when we, or earlier when we talked about the story of the healing of the man with the demon in the Gerasene area, it was raised that, like, maybe people were just really uncomfortable around him because of how he was, and didn't want to engage with him because of that discomfort. So it's important to name that, because when you name what makes you uncomfortable, it helps you come to a path of understanding why it makes you uncomfortable. So both naming discomfort for a community, a congregation, but also, like, personal discomfort. So we're going to ask you all to break into small groups and just kind of think about your own context, your own congregation or community, and just talk with your neighbors about all of these questions. Just kind of go down the list, talk about it. If there's one that really stands out to you, you can kind of dig into that. But we're gonna ask you to do that for about 10 minutes, and then we'll come together as a large group to kind of share what we're learning.
This is something that you've discovered, perhaps, that you hadn't even really thought about, discovered about your context. Maybe be brave enough to share that, especially if it's a discomfort. So, all right.
Go for it.
Let's do it. We'll come and join you.
You are. Yeah.
Come.
I'm Rick.
Hi,
Rick. I'm
Linda. And Linda?
Linda.
And Anne. Anne's my wife's name. That's easy to remember. So, what do you want to take a share?
Send me a picture of the NFT. Very
important. My feeling is...
Our pastor was a bishop of the Southwest Synod. 4 years or 5 years. And so he was a long-term pastor for 26 years. And was elected bishop, so he had to leave the church. And we went through a transition period that stretched out about 2 years from the pulpit. And found it absolutely the one she was fabulous. According to my but I was on the call today, so I would be with people on the call. And there were other people in the congregation who did not take the person. And so there was rivalry. No, they still stayed.
What is our next?
So she decided that maybe it was best if she followed her calling. And she is actually on her airplane next Wednesday to work with the ELCA supporting different ministries in Egypt. In the meantime, so the chaplain was
and it depends on what the problem is.
So
kind of
long-term guys came around for a long time, the love file, of course, and he made a lot of his wife to do something that his father well, a wonderful young woman. And the process before that, we had another calling that we extended to an individual that was still
that happened before the Oh, we're not
flying. why, remember why we
in the larger communities, within the community, are there
Feel so brave to share, or confident, whatever, however you feel. Does anybody want to share something that came up, something that maybe even something that upon reflection that you kind of knew about your context, maybe you discovered a little bit more in talking about it, or just something that you've always known to be true? What, something about your context?
Our group looked at having a building, using a building, what's it for, how much are we going to spend on it, for
what? Building questions, right? How much mental energy do we spend on building questions about the stories and the anxieties and the hopes and the good uses for our buildings as well, right? That's the building's a big thing, right? It's a resource, and it's also questions like, oh my gosh, what if we've got this 200-year-old old building, and the idea of like, maybe we should take out the pews so we can use, nope, we're not even going to finish that sentence. All right, so other things, I love the building, that's a whole genre of things, right? Yeah.
I learned about their church a bit, which is predominantly white in a predominantly white part of Washington, and is a purple church, they described it in terms of politics, but what's interesting is that the memory of the sexuality conversations from 2002, 2003, 2004, and they had a word alone contingency, which was a group that was not wanting to change anything and was very much against more inclusivity for LGBTQ folks. Over 100 people left at that point.
Worshiping people.
Worshiping people.
From about 250 to about 150.
Yeah, and then in 2009 it became ELCA policy, but they'd already lost 100 and some folks. So that memory is so strong in 2019 that they don't want to touch anything political because of the hit.
You've got these stories, these open wounds, these stories from our past that inform, and it's amazing. Something that I've noticed in a lot of communities
over 10 years
is the trauma then gets passed down to people who themselves did not experience the first trauma, but they sense the trauma in community.
Later, so far as I know, we're the only open lesbians in the whole church, and we never felt uncomfortable from day one.
Okay,
and so we're well known in the church as on the council, and. But when we brought up, why are we not reconciling, it was immediately a non-starter.
Right.
It's like, we won't even talk about it. Don't even mention that word, because you're gonna, it's going to bring up too much pain.
What conversations won't we have is maybe a huge indicator of the conversations we need to have, right? That's
Amen.
Incredible.
Yeah.
All right.
So our congregation about 10 years ago went through a social a social awakening and actually called in therapy to help the two groups. And again, we had a group that left and a group that stayed, and we're stronger. But from that was one step and two steps. And then we just recently became a RIC church. And that was a whole other conversation. But because that first two steps had been handled and handled, I think, pretty well when it came to how the church body actually went through the process, it was much easier to have that conversation the second time through. And part of that may be that strong conservative, you know, not in my church, not my church name to use in talking with legislatures and talking
sure.
That contingent decided this is not the place for us.
Yeah.
And my, you know, at that time I was president of the council, and someone told me, and I don't remember who it was, it may have been the pastor, but he said, people join and leave churches all the time for all different kinds of reasons. Sometimes you just have to let it go and love them and say, you know, God go with you, but allow that to happen.
So there's part of your story, what I'm hearing is a part of your story that maybe, for us to talk there, what are we good at, or what have we done well yet? What is the part of our story that we can lean into and for our future story going forward, right? So I know sometimes we can be a little critical. We're going to focus on what makes us uncomfortable, but sometimes it's really important to look at what are the things we're good at? What are the positive stories that we tell ourselves, and to lean into those things and continue to live those stories. I think that looking at the time, we should probably move on to design and action plan. Do you want to talk about design and action plan? I'll keep going. So in thinking of a design and action plan, let's think about sometimes the word that I like to use is thinking about staging an intervention, right? To change something about the system, to maybe put a, sometimes it might be putting a wrench in the gears, sometimes it may be putting healing a wound, right? Staging some sort of intervention that we believe is going to move us in the right direction. So, so in process with your group again, what we're looking for is maybe even the inkling of an idea of something that we could do in our context that might change the conversation and move us in the direction that we want to go in a really practical way, right? Maybe we've identified, you know, maybe you haven't even identified the exact goal point that you want to do, but you've identified that there's some brokenness that we need to heal, or we've identified here there's something we can get really good at, and maybe we can employ that context. So thinking about who are the stakeholders and who should be involved, who holds influence, we say this in a very neutral way, right? We know that our church councils and the pastors, and we've got all these people who's hold formal influence. We also know that all of our context has people who have no formal influence and have a great deal of informal influence, right? That's okay. Let's recognize who those people are and bring them into the conversation and ask the question, how do we want to engage the stakeholder, all the stakeholders and the influencers in the conversation that we want to have? How does this leverage our strengths, right? We have a story. The fact that we all exist in some sense and our communities continue to exist, we have some strengths, and that's part of our story, and we want to leverage those and lean into those. How does this challenge us? Again, conversations that we don't want to have are often the ones we need to have. How can we create the optimal level of discomfort? This one I think is really interesting, right? When you learn something, this is anything, right? If you are super comfortable in the learning process, you're probably not really learning anything at all. If you are so wildly uncomfortable that you can't handle it, then you're going to disengage from the entire process. Good leaders manage that level of discomfort. They think, here's where I am, there's where we want to go. We're going to push people into the place that we think that people are going to stay connected in their discomfort and keep moving, and then we'll keep moving the bounds of their discomfort farther and farther away until we get where we want to go. But we have no interest in just, you know, bludgeoning people with, this is where we're going over here. We're going to manage their level of discomfort. And then, eventually, what do we imagine will be accomplished? That may be an open question, particularly in this conversation now. So, why don't we do this? Why don't we get back into our groups and imagine your context and think what, and we'd love for us to bring these back to the group and share with one another, because we only have really neat ideas that we haven't thought about before and want to share with one another. Anything you want to add? All right, let's do that.
Oh,
We'll do like 7-8 minutes of this, and then we'll probably go 3 minutes over, but you know, we'll try to manage our time respectfully.
Your congregation especially in the Northwest.
Yeah.
We are the least church.
Did you say style? Well, we are well known in our community. And so we tend to attract those questions. We all know that major population over and over again.
When I think of the stakeholders,
I was thinking of
the families
involving them.
So much of
us,
for example, is taking for everybody who
has influence
and how can we possibly
and then she's the person who finds someone who is. So you'll have someone like that.
I think that our pastor who just recently left was very, very
And I know that it has to be a priority or they're not going to be.
What she was really good at was saying, it's okay if you don't make churches. It's okay if you can't make churches. Instead of building people, you say, why won't you have churches? You have a history of churches. So, there's some of that. If I haven't seen something for quite a while, lovingly to say. But giving people permission. My wife and I are very involved, even though we are very involved with the social media. My wife is worship and music. We're all present. So we were very, very active and very busy in the church. We had been in, I think, in service 3 times this summer. And I also brought 23
still remaining engaged.
But it's okay if you're not in church.
Yeah. But there's also the people who are willing to kind of hear what they say, and they may not be what they may be doing.
Young families are saying,
sit at the table, and are interested in being there.
How do we versus those who.
So that it don't want to engage and really have some mistakes.
I think one of the things that we were really good at was involving all different generations. We did not have women's group. We did not have men's group. We did not have the high school group. We did things together as a congregation. And people of all ages were welcome.
And
there's a lot of opening
days.
If nobody shows up, I guess that says that not
a question. Oh, I'm not saying nobody, but people don't.
And
but it's not the people that you're really looking at. It's the people who are there.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about it.
Fortunately, in Northwest, we have a wide variety of activities. We've always been outdoors type people. So during a ski trip, come out there.
Is that too much?
Doing sledding, family sledding. People encourage to bring friends.
And where is Ryan from now?
Come out and disappear. So, understand what you're saying, because it's very, very difficult.
The next possible.
It wasn't until we changed pastors to younger children. We started the pastoral process. She decided that her calling was elsewhere, so we're now in transition. Yeah, we're in the call process. We just elected the call committee last Sunday. Thank you
very much. And you know, I think really what we need to be doing right now is
looking at the earlier question.
We just had a pastor.
I would also add, like, what in the cycle interested in.
Okay, so is there anyone who would be willing to share kind of what your group talked about? Just kind of your process of talking through the questions, or if there was one that you all really focused on?
I guess we'll talk. So we're in this challenge of our pastor of 20 years is retiring at the end of November. So some of this, we're going to be in a transition period anyway. And we're going to have that opportunity around a call to be thinking about some, you know, what challenges us, where are we trying to go as a congregation. But as we were thinking specifically around the race piece, we actually think that for us in Southwest Washington, we have an opportunity to work with a statement that just came out of our last Senate assembly denouncing the doctrine of discovery and encouraging all of our congregations in the Senate to engage with our Native American populations. There were actually 17 tribes in our region that obviously have been impacted by the church and church doctrine over hundreds of years. And so we actually, because we do not have a large, we certainly don't have a large migrant Hispanic kind of population. We don't have a large African American population. This might actually be a way for us to address some of this sense of white entitlement and race in a way that makes it a little less comfortable for our congregation, and then build upon that over time to other populations.
And yet it's relevant.
But yet it's relevant, and that's relevant
when,
to
when Ahmed asked us, well, you know, who do you have around your neighborhood? And it's just like a bunch of white people. And that's when we were like, oh, wait, but we don't. We have a lot of Native Americans.
Yeah, that's a really great example. You're looking around, seeing who's around. You're also looking to see what is happening kind of on a synodical level, and kind of trying to bring those two together, which is really great. So good luck.
And hopefully we'll give us some resources.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Thank you for sharing. Anyone else?
Could I just ask a question?
Yes.
Maybe, but I'll let, if another group wants to share first, defer. Well, my question is, like, how do you, in your experience, how do you know how to make somebody optimally uncomfortable? Or what are the signs and symptoms that you have made them uncomfortable enough to do something, but, I mean, but also not too uncomfortable? You know, like, obviously, like, I imagine if you're a medical practitioner, that's fairly easy to gauge, you know, by how the person's responding physically. But just curious, which, how you gauge that?
Yeah, so I'm going to share an example from a community organizing group that I'm a part of. For the last couple of months, they've been bringing church folks on these bus tours of part of D.C. that spans both sides of the Anacostia River. So D.C. is bordered by the Potomac and then the Anacostia. And historically, the areas around the Anacostia are historically African-American neighborhoods and have experienced a lot of disinvestment from the city. But the city, in its kind of taking inventory of all the land, is looking at all of these kind of waterfront areas along the river, and they're like, hey, you know what?
Revitalization.
Really valuable. Revitalization, there you go. And like this kind of came to a head when Amazon was considering D.C. itself as a place to be. But anyway, the city kind of is fixated on, like, we're going to revitalize these areas. And we have this big plan to do so, but it involves kind of taking down some of the public housing, pushing out communities, and so this community organizing group is seeing what's going on and organize these bus tours to like drive people around the neighborhoods that are slated for redevelopment to just show everybody the scope of what's going on. And afterwards, as everybody was reflecting together, they were saying, like, wow, this made me so uncomfortable because this is happening in my community. I had no idea. But something needs to be done about this. And I think that was kind of the optimal level of discomfort because people could kind of like see everything, engage with each other. But I think just also kind of listening to what people were reflecting on, if they had gone out and gone into a neighborhood and immediately gone door knocking, like knocked on strangers' doors to kind of hear their stories and see everything, I think people would have been a little uncomfortable because it's not something they've done before. It's not a neighborhood they've been in before. So I don't think that would have elicited the same response as kind of those bus tours, which introduce people to the issue and to the area and to the neighborhoods. So that now this group is going out and doing the door knocking. And so many of the people who are on the bus tours now feel this connection and are taking action.
I think a paradigm that I think is sometimes like boredom, disengagement, right? If you're bored, you're not challenged enough. If you disengage, you may be too uncomfortable and give up. So I think that's a good example of managing boredom versus disengagement.
All right, so anything to add to either this or any more questions or just kind of reflections on our last 3 days together? Okay, well, if not, thank you all so much for coming and engaging and sharing some of your stories. We've just really valued and appreciated the time that we've had together this week.
Honored to be with you all.